From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we're rebroadcasting some favorite conversations. Journalist Naomi Klein discusses her new book, No Is Not Enough, Resisting the New Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. And Emmy winner Regina King joins us for a career conversation. But first, from the ongoing fight with the media, the deepening Russia scandal, and the messy fight over health care, it doesn't look like the Trump White House's political troubles will end anytime soon. Yet his closest aides and members of the Republican Party continue to support his message, publicly at least. Our next guest is George Lakoff. He's an author and professor emeritus of cognitive science and linguistics at UC Berkeley. He joins us now to unpack the power and the science of President Trump's messaging. I got inundated with questions that people wanted me to ask you when I had you back on this program. So I'm glad to have you back.
My pleasure. It's really great to be here.
My great delight to see you, sir. I had tons and tons of questions all over social media for Professor Lakoff. This one comes from Shelley Singh Henry. The attempts by our new administration to condition citizens to discredit the media and distract from their underlying agenda are becoming more obvious. Would love to hear Professor Lakoff as he explains the scientific factors at work used to assist the Trump administration's plans. Why is he being so effective? And by effective, I just mean that it's conversation 24/7 whenever he says anything about the news media. What's behind that, and why is it so effective?
Well, first, it works because first, all ideas are in your neural circuitry. They're in your brain. They don't float in the air. Mm-hmm. Once you hear them, anytime you hear them, if you understand them, it activates some neural circuit to understand them. Anytime it's repeated, it activates that circuit again. And the more it's repeated, the stronger it gets. And as the circuits are more activated, at some point, they become semi-permanent or then permanent. So if he starts attacking the media as saying fake news, fake news, fake news, then people who believe what he says, as people who have strict father morality and have his view of how the world should be, mm-hmm. are not going to they're not going to hear that on the media. They're not going to hear his version on the media, and so they're going to say, oh, the problem is that the media is against him and against us.
Mm. And all he has to do to make that believable, to make that an issue for the people who support him, is merely just to keep saying it?
He has to keep saying it, and saying it in such a way that it goes against, it goes in favor of the people who believe him and what their moral view is. When Trump got elected, these people said, finally, America is the way it should be. Mm-hmm. It's the way we understand it. And of course, a lot of liberals said, now we're oppressed. You know, now we have to resist and we have mm-hmm. to persist and say other things and change all this. Mm. This is part of the way things work in people's brains. When you have two opposite views of the world, they're there physically in your brain. And when they're about morality, about what's right and what's wrong, they define who you are as a person. And you don't want to vote against who you are as a person. You don't want to argue against who you are as a person. And, you know, and if the country doesn't fit who you are as a person, if what you see on TV doesn't fit it, if it fits the opposite view, you feel that that's got to be wrong because I can't be wrong. Mm-hmm. I can't be a wrong person. I know what's right and wrong, so they got to be wrong.
Mm-hmm. You used the word morality a moment ago, and I want to come to that. I read a piece in the New York Times. Fascinating piece. It raised a lot of questions for me. I think that the two professors, the two researchers who wrote the article, missed some critical pieces in their analysis. So I wasn't in total agreement with the piece, but I read the piece and I was fascinated by it because the piece spoke to the research that they had done on Hillary Clinton's tweets and Donald Trump's tweets 6 months out from Election Day. They spent a lot of time, these two researchers, analyzing both of their tweets. And one of the takeaways from the article was that Trump has done a masterful job, my word, not theirs, but a masterful job of putting out what they called morally charged tweets.
Absolutely.
Morally charged tweets. That he did that much better, they argue, than Hillary Clinton did.
Oh, yeah.
These morally charged tweets. And as a result, Trump had a 15% higher retweet rate.
Yes.
Than Hillary did. So he's better at morally charged tweets. They resonate with this audience around these issues of morality. They get retweeted a great deal more than Hillary's tweets. And then they went on not just to analyze hers, but to look at Republicans and Democrats and the Senate and how they tweet. I'm raising that with you now since you mentioned the word morality. What is it about these morally charged tweets that Trump is so good at that gets under people's skin, that makes half of us upset and the other half love him and retweet what he says?
Because all of our politics is based on morality. If anybody gets up and says, here's my policy, do what I say, the assumption is it's right, not wrong. Mm-hmm. They don't say it's evil, do it. You know, the assumption is it's right. And, you know, and you have two opposite views of what's right. What I've called a nurturant model, one where you assume that government cares. As Lincoln said, it's of, by, and for the people. For the people means government cares. Mm-hmm. You have another version of that in progressive thought, where citizens care about other citizens, work through the government to provide public resources so that everybody has their well-being served, their protection, and freedom served. Mm-hmm. And this is true both of businesses and ordinary people. Now, that is crucial to progressive thought. And the problem is that nobody ever says it. Though that is crucial, it's part of the unconscious way of which, what's behind thought. 98% of thought is unconscious. Mm-hmm. It's carried out by your neural system. Thoughts don't float in the air. They're in your neural system. And you don't have conscious access to it. So what's conscious is tiny compared to what's unconscious, and these moral systems are part of your unconscious, but they determine everything you think is right and wrong. Mm-hmm. And you have two opposite views of right and wrong here. So this is crucial. That's why morality matters. Now, Hillary went out and says, she didn't talk about morality. I tried to convince her to do so once, but didn't work. Mm-hmm. She didn't do it. She talked about competence. You know, I have experience, I know better, I am strong, I know how to work with the other side, all of that stuff. No morality, mm-hmm. nothing. Everything Trump said was about morality, about right and wrong. And it was his version of right and wrong. And in his tweets have a structure. People think that he's crazy and he does crazy things at night. The opposite is true. He has four types of tweets. One of them is what I call preemptive framing. He tries to frame the issue his way first in one of the tweets. So he tries to get the people to believe it his way before they have a chance to do anything else.
We saw that with Comey and a litany of things, but the Comey thing comes to mind immediately.
Comey came to mind, yeah. But also, you know, there were 3 to 5 million illegal votes.
Oh, yeah.
All of that.
Sure, yeah. Right. So preemptive framing.
Preemptive framing.
Okay.
The second is diversion. The Russian thing is getting close to him, so he, attacks somebody in the media. And he creates a diversion, and then for the several days, they don't talk about Russia, they talk about something else.
Right.
So diversion. Then there's attack the messenger. Somebody says something about him being awful or wrong, and he comes back 10 times as strong and attacks the person who said it. And that can be the media. If the media reports honestly on something that doesn't fit what he says or suggests that he's doing something illegal mm-hmm. or immoral, then he comes back and attacks the messenger. Mm-hmm. The fourth is trial balloons. You know, say, everybody should have nuclear weapons. Let's see if that one works, you know, or whatever, some crazy idea that
he has. Or I'll do a cybersecurity deal with Putin.
Yes.
Let's float that, see if that works.
Let's see if that works.
Yeah,
no,
yeah,
it didn't
yeah.
work. But it's
yeah.
a trial balloon, you know?
Yeah.
That, right, those are the four things and combinations of those. Every tweet is one of those four things. Mm-hmm. No matter when it comes in, it's always one of those four things at least, and maybe two at once. So these are strategies he has. They're not, you know, crazy things that he whips off in the middle of the night. They're things that he thinks will help him with his base.
Okay. So why can't the minds, I really don't want to believe that he's any brighter than the people who run news organizations in this country. They're educated at the same schools. They've got experience in the same way he does in their own lane. I do not believe that Donald Trump is smarter, wiser than the people who run the news business in this country. So my question is this, based on that assumption, why can't they just decide to not cover his tweets? I mean, in other words, why not cover what he does or doesn't do policy-wise, but not cover the Trump sideshow? Why can't they just decide in their own minds, we're just not going to cover those tweets. We're not going to cover that nonsense.
Money. The Nielsen ratings.
But I hear that, and I'm not even pushing back. I get the money in the news ratings, but they say, Professor, that they don't like him calling them fake. They don't like the way he attacks the news. They don't like. But they diss him for saying it, but they disseminate it to all the rest of us.
All right, exactly. And here's why. Whenever you use somebody else's language, for moral language, you are helping them.
Right.
Because every word that is defined relative to someone else's moral language activates that circuit in somebody's brain, in the public's brains, and every time it's activated, it gets stronger. In order to negate something, you have to activate what you're negating. So, like when Nixon said, I am not a crook, everyone thought of him as a crook.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a book called Don't Think of an Elephant. You know, you think of an elephant.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So there are all these people in the news media who have a false belief about reason. A lot of people who are educated in journalism school, I often lecture at the Berkeley Journalism mm-hmm. School, or in political science courses and so on, they learn that reason is, as Descartes said in 1650. Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. He assumed all thought is conscious, 98% unconscious. He said, he was a mathematician. He says, when I think, it's like going through a proof in mathematics, that thought is logic.
Mm-hmm.
He said that that notion of rationality is what makes us rational animals, human beings. So everybody has the same rationality. Now, that is what's taught implicitly in journalism school and in and also that language is literal. It just fits the world mm-hmm. as it is, can't be metaphorical and so on, when it is metaphorical. So what happens is people learn that view of what thought is, and then they can't get out of it. So they think that if they diss somebody, which is negating what they said, they're actually helping the other person, but they don't know it because they think thought is logic. And in logic, negations negate something and wipe it out.
Mm-hmm. So it seems so simple, but the media doesn't seem to understand it.
Because they took the wrong classes.
And that's what I was trying. I could not say it as brilliantly as you just said it. It just seems to me that what the media is missing as they cover these stories, as they cover these tweets like they're legitimate stories, is that they are aiding and abetting. They're being complicit in helping advance his agenda.
Exactly. You go and look at MSNBC, and they're constantly saying, so-and-so said this, and this fact shows it's wrong, and this fact shows it's wrong.
Yeah.
Every time they do that, they help the other side.
Mm.
Instead of positively saying what's true in such a way that it is clear that that would undercut the other side.
So we should reframe how we resist.
Exactly. Let me give you a nice example
okay.
of this. Take the notion of regulations. Trump wants to get rid of all regulations. Regulations are words that come from the corporate world. You know, corporate worlds hate regulations. They say regulations are expensive. They keep us from doing whatever we want. If we want to put pollution in the world, they stop us from doing that because we can make more money doing that. Regulations are there for a reason, protection. To protect people. You know, the Affordable Care Act, real name of it is the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. They should have called it the Patient Protection Act. The point is, if you talk about protections and you say, get up and say, we're going to get rid of 3/4 of the protections that the government has,
mm-hmm.
how would it sound? You know, we're going to get rid of all the protections. Everybody who's protected, we're going to get rid of your protections. It would sound crazy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who would accept that? But that's the reality. And the question is, when you have these two realities with different viewpoints, a corporate viewpoint that says regulations are bad, we can make more money without them, and then the people who are protected by them who say, wait a minute, these are protections, the choice of words matters.
Mm.
That's why it matters. And what happens, in the front pages of the New York Times, they use the words regulation, regulation, regulation when they talk about the EPA regulations being cut rather than the EPA protections being cut.
Mm. You mentioned reason a moment ago, and I could be totally off base here. If I am, you correct me. But when you start talking about reason, I started thinking about Trump and as you laid out so nicely, how effective he is with his tweets, et cetera, et cetera, and thinking about, conversely, where the Democrats keep coming up short. And it seems to me that the Democrats, and even Barack Obama as president for 8 years, just totally misread the notion of reason. I get the sense sometimes that Barack Obama, when he was president, and Democrats even to this day think that if you just tell people the truth, if you just tell them the facts, that everything...
They'll reason to the right conclusion.
They'll reason to the right conclusion.
Not only that, Obama in his farewell speech said exactly that. He said, you know, enlightenment reason is what is essential for democracy. That's what we have to do. Just help people get the facts out there. People will reason to it.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton, in her speech at Wellesley, where she went and gave a graduation mm-hmm. speech, and she said, what's wonderful about Wellesley is they teach enlightenment reason, right? Now, if you're a conservative and you go to college, what are you going to study? Probably going to take some business courses. In that curriculum, you're going to take marketing. People who teach marketing know that people really reason unconsciously, that they use frames, that they use narratives, that they use metaphors, that they use images, and that they use emotion. That is normal reason. That's what people really think, and everybody who does marketing knows this, mm-hmm. right? But the people who go to college and are progressives and become democratic leaders and so on, they won't take the marketing course. They also won't take cognitive science, and they won't take neuroscience, which would teach you the same thing. Instead, what they do is they'll take a course like political science or law or public policy or economic theory, not business economics, mm-hmm. and they teach enlightenment reason from 1650. And it's just false. And not only that, they all got A's in this. They're really smart. You know? They're really smart. They're good people. They have the right unconscious values.
Yeah.
Right?
Unconscious values. I love that. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's true. And the Democratic Party is wedded to this intuition. One, they're wedded to that view of reason. And two, they hire people who are consultants and pollsters who are also wedded to that view of reason. Mm-hmm. So everything they put out is like that. And when you have that view of reason, then everything becomes an issue by issue, one issue. Instead of the general notion that there are bigger things, like care, mm-hmm. that democracy requires care, as Lincoln said, and as progressive politics says, you know, citizens care about other citizens, and what mm-hmm. they do with the government money is to get money that will provide for people's well-being and care and protection and freedom, not just in private life, but also in their business lives. And that has been true since the beginning of our country. At the beginning of our country, you had public education, you had roads and bridges, of course, for companies and to get their goods to market, interstate commerce for companies, you had a national bank, a patent office, a judicial system 90% for corporate law. You know, all of this was to help people, mostly who were in business, but also private citizens. And that is how the country was set up. You provide public resources for everybody. That's how that worked. Now, you also have, in medicine, we have spent a half a century to a century paying in advance for the development of modern medicine through the government, through the NIH, and through universities. You have, in science, how did you get computer science? It didn't just come from nowhere, it didn't fall from the sky. It had to be supported by DARPA and from the Defense Department and the NSF. Where did satellite communication come from? NASA and NOAA. What about cell phones? How did you get cell phones and GPS systems? They don't fall from the sky. You know, it's done by the Defense Department. They have over 50 satellites going around at any one time. 24 of them are active. They're at 51%, 51 degrees at an angle from the equator. And at any time, four of them can focus on any point on Earth. Okay? So what happens if you want to make a cell phone call? You take your cell phone and you go send a message to a tower. The message goes at the speed of light. The tower has a switching system. Then it goes at the speed of light to the satellite. Then that has a switching system. It sends it, does the switching, sends it the speed of light switching around the world to the person you're calling in Europe, down to the tower, down to the satellite. Now, How fast does that have to go? And the switching systems, speed of light in between, the switching systems have to go in nanoseconds, billionths of a second. Billions. If they're a millionth of a second off, your message is hundreds of miles off. Your cell phone call is not 15 to 30 feet, it's hundreds of miles. Your GPS system is off. Now, how many businesses in the world use cell phones?
Every one of them.
Every one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Your dollars that are paying for this system are supporting not only the American economy, but the economy of the world. And Russia and China are trying to get their systems up there. Now, this is crucial. Most people have no idea about this. And not only that, our politicians don't tell you. They don't tell you that the private depends on the public, that private enterprise and private life depend absolutely on such public resources. You couldn't do anything without public resources. And the Republicans think that they all did it themselves. You know, I did everything myself. I'm a self-made man. Hardly. You didn't build the roads. You know, you didn't invent computer science. You didn't pay for it. You know, it's crazy. They use these wonderful government resources that the entire country paid for. And think about it in terms of healthcare. We paid for this medical system. We paid for the development of the drugs through the NIH, for the training of the doctors, for all the medical research that went into all of this was paid for initially, and the research was funded by places like NIH and universities and public universities. You know, and this is crucial. Most people don't realize this. They don't understand that, in fact, when you get a treatment from your insurance company, if you can have insurance, you actually paid in advance for the development of that treatment. Well, if that's an investment, why isn't that a dividend? You know, if you're looking for an argument for universal health care, that's the place to start. This is a dividend because you've already paid for the development of the medicine.
All righty. That's why I wanted you back. That is why I asked you back. I apologize. I had all these questions in my head that I wanted to get to, but the professor, as always, was so brilliant. Forgive me for not getting to more of your questions, but I did just want to acknowledge that so many of you reached out to us after his last appearance on this show. So that just means you got to come back again. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. My next guest, Naomi Klein, is an award-winning journalist and author of several best-selling texts, including No Logo and The Shock Doctrine, in which she reveals how America's free market policies have come to dominate the world. Her latest book is called No Is Not Enough, Resisting the New Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. In the book, she argues that the election of President Trump was a logical extension of trends of the past half century. She joins us now to tell us more. Naomi, good to have you back on this program.
Great to be with you, Davis.
Good to see you. You regard Trump's election in November not as a peaceful transition of power, but as a corporate takeover. Unpack that for me.
Well, look, he ran this campaign promising to be the savior of the white working class, promising to take on Wall Street, said he was so rich he didn't need anybody's money. He attacked his rivals in the Republican Party and Hillary Clinton for being in the pocket of Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. He was going to drain the swamp, take the lobbyists out. And what has he done? Five Goldman Sachs executives in his cabinet, which is incredible. He's not the first president to spin that revolving door, but never to this degree. And appointed the CEO of Exxon to be his Secretary of State, which, you know, there's so many sort of shocking events in the Trump presidency. We can forget just how shocking that is. The largest private oil company, a company that was under investigation by three states' attorneys general in the United States for knowing about climate change, doing its research into climate climate change and then deceiving the public, deceiving their shareholders, and on and on. There are many examples of this where it's just almost like they cut out the middleman. You know, the mask is off, and it's just kind of like that idea: if you want something done right, do it yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's sort of what's happening with Trump's cabinet of millionaires and billionaires, and they're pushing through the wish list, or they're trying to, on tax policy, health policy, this transfer of wealth, systematic from lower and middle income people to the 1% of the 1%.
It's one thing to define a corporate takeover by the personnel that one chooses. That's different, can be different, than the policies they advance. Just because it's one set of personnel doesn't mean they have to advance a certain set of policies. But I hear you starting to make the argument that this personnel group is advancing policies that you would expect in a corporate takeover.
And is once again very different from how Trump campaigned, because he did promise to renegotiate trade deals in the interest of workers, and now it turns out that his idea for renegotiating NAFTA is to make it even better for corporations and worse for workers. He promised to protect people's health care, their social security. He's attacking it, and frankly, I don't think we've seen the worst, because you know, if they get their tax cut through, then they're going to create a budget crisis, right? They're going to run out of money, and then that will become the pretext for even going after Social Security even more, I think, an even more radical agenda.
I asked this question to some friends in a conversation the other day, somewhat rhetorically, but not really. But I want to ask you seriously now on this program, which is how the media can get away with dissing the president and disseminating the tweets at the same time. I don't know how you do both of those. You can't. Now, my point is, you can't act like you're mad at this guy for calling you fake news 24/7. You know, and you're acting like you're really upset with this guy for dissing you, but you keep disseminating the tweets. How do you diss and disseminate at the same time? And the second thing is the media really that upset with Trump? I mean, they act like they're really upset with this guy for dissing them and calling them names, et cetera, et cetera, and going after Joe and Mika and going after CNN. Mm-hmm. We're all so upset with the president going after the media. Are they really that upset if they keep covering him and if their ratings stay up? How mad are they really?
I think this is a really reciprocal relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think that, look, I mean, this idea that they are standing up for the truth in the face of this president who's attacking the press, well, then show us, you know? Let's really dig into some truth here and see some really powerful investigative reporting. And this is why it matters. And I think, honestly, we are seeing the fallout from treating news as a commercial business. Because if it is a commercial business, and it is, you know,
it is,
then they're just... They're following their business imperative. Mm-hmm. They're following the ratings because and we're all complicit in this, right? Everybody who turns it on and who feeds this addiction, who clicks on the on that clickbait instead of maybe a little bit of a less sexy story like the implications of Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord. You know, we're all part of this, and we need to send feedback through our viewing and reading habits that show that we actually do care about this. But I do think that the greater responsibility lies with the media. But the real issue in terms of, you know, whether the media is pro-Trump or anti-Trump, the real issue is that one of the major issues is that the leadership in the Democratic Party is fueling this. Like, if they wanted to turn the focus to the economic betrayal, say, and some of the polling really shows that when you put to Trump voters these basic facts about how many Goldman Sachs executives he's appointed, they really don't like it, right? Well, why aren't the Democrats making more hay out of this? Well, maybe that has something to do with their own proximity to Wall Street and an unwillingness to really seize back some of the economic populist ground, right? And build a genuinely multiracial coalition around a promise of redistributing some of the wealth that is so stuck at the top and using it to pay for universal health care and upping the minimum wage and these things that will really be resonant.
How would the Democrats get that message out? How could they do that truthfully when they were behind a candidate who was giving speeches to Goldman Sachs, et cetera, et cetera, making a bunch of money? So I hear your point, and I think you're right about that. But how do you, with a straight face, advance that agenda now when the person you were behind was taking the same money?
Well, I think that this is about what the next step is, you know, and getting ready. And this is why, you know, I called it no is not enough, because it isn't enough to just expose Trump as a fraud, as a hypocrite, whatever it is. That's part of it. But the other part of it is is making an offer that says, this is the real thing. You know, mm-hmm. this is how we address the urgent need that Trump was tapping into for jobs.
But that's
right?
the Bernie Sanders yeah. agenda, which they rejected. Yeah. They didn't want Bernie as their nominee.
They did. They did reject it last time.
So that's my question. So how now? You see what I'm getting at, right?
Luckily, it's not only up to them. With the, you know, there are voters who get to intervene at a certain point. I just came back from a week in the UK, spent some time with Jeremy Corbyn and people around him. They've just come out of this election cycle where they didn't win the election, but they won a historic number of seats, and they did much, much better than was expected. The whole idea of calling this snap election in the UK was to wipe out Jeremy Corbyn. What turned it around for him was putting forward a manifesto, as they call it in the UK, that put workers front and center, major investments in the universal public healthcare system that has been starved, better wages, taking climate change seriously, welcoming refugees, ending wars, really a transformative agenda that spoke to people's better selves. And it turned out that you can lead with ideas, but you do need a trusted messenger.
When in your subtitle you used the phrase, winning the world we need, winning the world we need. A few questions unfairly, but I'll put them out and give you the space you need to answer them. One, these days, what do we mean by winning? I'm not sure the definition of winning for the U.S. now, particularly for the U.S., is the same definition that I would have given 20, 40 years ago. So what is winning, number one? And when you say the world we need, can we agree on the world that we need? And finally, what do you say to those persons, those Trump supporters, who feel like they're not a part of that we to begin with?
You know, it's funny, we had big debates about the we in the title.
I can't imagine that.
Because just saying we is political.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
In this, who is the we?
Yeah.
Who is the we? But I went for it anyway. Mm-hmm. I risked a we. And I guess part of it is just coming from the climate justice movement and feeling pretty confident that the economic and social model that we have right now is at war with life on Earth, and that there has to be a we. And I can't control if everybody, you know, if there, certainly there's going to be Trump supporters who are never going to feel included in that we. But I mean, the truth is, I did write the book for, you know, I wrote the book for the movement. It is a movement. Mm-hmm. It is a movement book. And I think we live at a time when people who identify with being part of the resistance is growing. Mm-hmm. You know, so if there's one thing we can thank Trump for, it's that he's been a kind of a wake-up call where a great many more people understand that he is a symptom of a system failure, not the failure itself, right? If Wall Street can cheer on news of his election, if you know Fortune 500 companies can line up behind this man, if he can be praised in the corporate press for launching missiles over chocolate cake at Mar-a-Lago, that there is something deeply sick at work, right? So that's the we I'm speaking to. It's the people who understand something is deeply, deeply wrong. And I'm trying to build a broader we, you know, trying to do a little bit of the work, and no one person can do it. And I am, you know, I'm so lucky to have you know, so many people who helped me with the book and who are doing this same work from different angles and trying to weave the we, you know, weave a broader we. But bringing it to climate, we have to be able to say that if we have an economic system that is bringing us every day closer to ecological collapse, we need a different world. And we can't be afraid to say we in that context. Sure. But we, at the same time, can't play, well, my crisis is bigger than your crisis. You know, climate, we'll fix climate first and then we'll fight poverty and racism. No, we have to find a way to solve multiple problems at once. We need punctuated transformation, change on multiple fronts. We need to radically bring down our emissions in a way that builds a much, much fairer economy and begins to heal wounds that date back to our country's founding. Yeah. And it is possible to do that. It is possible for the communities that have been on the front lines of the most abusive practices, including ecological practices, to be first in line to own and control their own renewable energy projects. And these are some of the solutions that I highlight in the book that I don't claim any kind of ownership over, that come from the movements themselves.
Well, I'm with her. Naomi, that is. The book is called No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World That We Need. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Regina King is a two-time Emmy winner. She made her television debut on the hit sitcom 227. She's appeared in so many films and TV projects since, including Jerry Maguire, Ray, and most recently John Ridley's American Crime, which garnered her two Emmy Awards and a Golden Globe nomination. Before we start our conversation with Regina, I'll look back at some of her brilliant work.
I don't know what you do for your 4%, but this man, my husband, has a whole plan, an image. And when you put him in a waterbed warehouse commercial, excuse me, you're making him common. When you know we deserve the big four. Shoe, car, clothing line, soft drink. I know about the four jewels of the celebrity endorsement dollar.
Wow.
I want you to leave her and come and be with our baby.
You got your damn mind. You knew the rules when you got into this. Good damn well I ain't gonna leave my family.
Leave your family. You are a damn fool, you know that. Between the dope and the music and me, you are ready to let your damn family. You see the way Jason smiles at you? No one else will ever love you like that. Ever. I want to know what that feels like, Reggie. I want to be able to hold that kind of love in my arms. I want to look in my child's eyes, and I want to see someone I care for.
So I'm laughing because it is so impressive to just look at that, because there are so many child actors who just don't make it.
Yeah.
And even those who do make it, don't make it in the way that you've made.
Yeah.
I mean, you have a serious body of work here.
I have been blessed, yes, to be able to do what I love. And, you know, when you sit there and watch it like that, you know, you're always living in the moment. Mm-hmm. So you don't think about all of the places that you've been before this moment right now. And it's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're very modest. It's more than cool.
Yeah. It is.
How do you reach, I mean, I guess this is what an actor's job, I guess, is, but how do you reach those emotional places that you're so good at that?
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think part of it is just, it's my art, you know, and I guess when a painter paints or a writer writes or a musician plays, whatever space they go into to express their creativity, it would be the equivalent to that. Yeah. You know, I've been training all my life, so there are, I guess, certain buttons inside that I push to you know, make certain things happen. But for the most part, I'm in the moment of the character that I'm playing. You know, I'm really channeling or trying to embody whatever that woman is in that piece.
Yeah. I don't know if this is a fair question. Let me ask anyway. When you were a kid getting started, is this what you wanted? Did you expect this? Or were you just having a good time?
Right.
And it not really processing
it? Yeah, it kind of started out as having a good time.
Yeah,
I wanted to be a dentist.
Yeah.
And then
nothing
I guess
wrong with that.
The realization of having to be in people's mouths, I think, kind of let that be a fleeting thing. But I loved my dentist growing up, so I think that's why, because he was such a great dentist.
Right.
And I always heard other kids talk about how much they hated their dentist, but I loved Dr. Rubel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's what made me want to be a dentist. But it was a hobby. I used to go to acting classes and so enjoyed it. My sister and I did it together, and we'd, you know, do plays and things like that. And then 227 came, and then it just kept going. And then I went to college and decided that I didn't want to stay in college. Yeah. I wanted to really approach it as a career opposed to a hobby.
Yeah. You were blessed, that's my word, and you'll choose your own word, to my mind.
I like that word.
You like that?
Yeah,
that word? Okay. So it seems to me that you were blessed, Regina, when you were on 227, in that you were around some veterans and some veteran black women.
Absolutely.
I mean, you could have started doing something else and not have been in that sort of incubator.
Mm-hmm.
That had to be.
It was, I mean, it's such
Gibbs
a big
and,
part of why I'm here. And I remind people all the time about Marla being one of the first, like with a trailblazer. Like, people forget Marla was the executive producer of 227 and the star of 227. And she had her own Marla's Memory Lane and acting. It wasn't an acting school. It was an acting, like, shrine, you know, because Marla, I got to get a front row seat to see how a woman who's a boss operates, and I didn't realize I was getting all of that as I was, you know, absorbing it, but I was, because I'm making, you know, similar moves now. So Marla, gosh, that's my other mommy.
Speaking of your similar moves, so you're not just acting, you're producing, you're writing, you're directing. Like, this is like...
Yeah, it's all been like a natural progression or expansion, I like to say, because I don't, I'm never leaving the one in the dust. It's kind of to do it all together. But I think one of the things that I love about acting is that, you know, we observe things, and that's what actors do. We take it in. You know, we're students of life, you know, just, you know, just that you do this all the time. If ever I was playing Tavis, I would remember to do this or this, you know. But I think because I'm taking it all in all the time, I'm able to employ these gifts that come along the way.
How has the, to the extent that it has, how has the directing aided your acting?
In a huge way. I think because at one aids the other. As a actor that went out and directed a film and then came back as an actor, I immediately respected the director even more. Not that I didn't respect the director before, but I was more willing to just the director tell me where you need me. We don't even need to talk about it. I'm gonna try it your way. And I guess it opened me up more in a lot of ways. And then as a director, just it helps my communication with other actors.
This might not be the words you choose, Regina, but it seems to me that if American Crime did nothing else for you, it stretched you. Those three seasons, I hate to see it go. And John was here not too long ago. But tell me about the experience of doing American Crime over those three seasons.
Oh, gosh, it is really hard to put that in words because, you know, as actors, we dream to be a part of a situation like that. Situation, for lack of a better word, to come to my mind quickly, I would say, because situation minimizes it, because it was such a beautiful...
Like utopia.
Yeah, really. You know, as actors, the perfect world is to have a repertory, like, feeling and get paid like you get paid on TV or movies, but not Broadway money. So we had that feeling. So at the end of one season, it was just the excitement to find out, well, what story are we going to tell this season? Well, what are we coming back to do? And John was so great at filling us in on a little bit, and we would have like a long conversation. John is not short on words. So
we know this.
So we would converse about the roles that he was thinking about for us to play for the next seasons. And, you know, we'd speak for hours, and he would take that, and they would go to the writer's room and then come back with these gems.
What's your end game, to the extent that there is one? What are you hoping to do with all the stuff that you are doing?
You know what? I think I don't think there is an end game. You know, I just you know, I got the battery in my back.
I love that.
Keep going, you know, when people ask, would you expect to be here? Did you think that this was going to be what your life is. I can't say that I thought that it was, but I can't say that I thought that it wasn't. I just feel like I've listened to the universe. I kind of just let the universe guide me. So there is no end game. Who's to say, you know, where when I come back and sit in this chair or where what I'll be talking about, or what I'll be doing.
Yeah.
It's
been fascinating to watch, and this is clearly a legitimate issue, and you've talked about this, and you've been very courageous to speak about it publicly, which is the lack of opportunity for people of color in this industry. And yet, while that is the reality, it's been empowering to watch you just keep moving anyway.
Yeah, I've had so many people that have been so supportive of whatever I want to do. When I was making the move to direct, just all of the men that embrace me in our industry, from Paris Barkley to John Wells to Christopher Chulock to John Singleton, and I can just name so many that, didn't allow me to doubt myself. They saw some things that I didn't even know existed.
I don't want to sound paternalistic, but I am so proud of you.
Thank you. I received that. Anybody says that they don't appreciate when someone genuinely expresses that, pays that forward, they're lying.
But just to watch the way you have grown, it's just such a beautiful thing.
Yeah, thank you. Still growing.
Yes,
still growing.
We all are. Good to see you, Regina.
Good to see you.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsiabwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.